Support for this public radio podcast comes from Lindblad Expeditions, exploring nature's wild, unspoiled places aboard its ships in partnership with National Geographic. Details at 1-800-EXPEDITION.
Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Yael Cassander, and today it is my honor and delight to introduce you to a musician who, although world-renowned, is very much grounded in Bloomington, Indiana. Gray Larson is one of the most highly regarded American practitioners of Irish flute and tin whistle. Although these days he's on the road a lot, performing concerts and leading workshops, more often than not, Gray is likely to turn up at the Irish Music Open Session on Tuesday nights at Bloomington's Runcible Spoon Cafe. Equally immersed in Scandinavian folk music and the old-time American repertoire, Larson plays a variety of whistles, flutes, fiddles, accordions, pianos, organs, and guitar. He's also a singer. Gray has distinguished himself not only as a player, composer, producer, and engineer, but also an archivist, author, and editor. In his well-received books, The Essential Guide to Irish Flute and Tin Whistle, and the companion volume, The Essential Tin Whistle Toolbox, Gray has cataloged, transcribed, and provided practical instruction in this music in an unprecedented way. Gray, welcome. You grew up in Cincinnati and eventually attended the Oberlin Conservatory of Music. Tell us about your relationship to music in those early years.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and my family was not what you would call a musical family. My parents didn't play music, but my father was one of those people that, you know, I always think that if he had chosen to be a musician, he could have been a great musician. He was very passionate about music. And there was a lot of music in his family, his father and his father's father, and kind of the Norwegian branch of my family. We're all very musical. And my dad was really passionate about music. And he had a harmonica, but I hardly ever heard him play it. But he played records all the time at home and just would get completely lost in the music and totally absorbed in music.
What records was he playing?
Well, it was a lot of classical music and a lot of folk music. So I grew up hearing especially classical music mm-hmm. being played in the house. You know,
Grieg?
Grieg, yes. Yes, among many others. uh-huh. And folk music like the Weavers and the Clancy Brothers and people like that. So from as far back as I can remember, there was a lot of music around me, but there wasn't music being played in the house.
And how did you discover your talent? How did you discover your talent and gravitate toward it and commit to it?
There certainly wasn't a conscious, you know, choice when I was a little kid to say, okay, and I'm going to make a commitment to music. I just always seemed to be in a musical world inside my head all the time. And I guess I started taking piano lessons when I was 4. And I guess when I was 3, I used to plunk around on the piano at the nursery school I went to. And apparently when we got there, I don't really remember this, but so I'm told I would always run straight to the piano and just reach up to the keyboard, and which was, you know, above my head, and just plunk away on the keys. And at one point, my parents recognized what I was plunking. I was playing the melody of Home on the Range, which is my favorite song at that time.
Okay.
And so I guess they asked me if I wanted to take piano lessons, and I said, yeah, you bet. So I started piano lessons when I was 4, you know, started learning to read music. I think probably before I was reading words, I was reading music notation.
No kidding. So it wasn't Suzuki method.
It was No, it was just like the lady down the street and the mailman and whoever. It was not a rigorous study of piano or a structured one, which in a way I'm really happy about, because it just gave me total freedom to explore and try to play what I was hearing on the radio, or, you know, I developed my ear really well at the same time as learning to read music. So I've always been a by-ear musician and a by-notation musician, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
music notation is really second nature for me. So,
but that combination is not necessarily very common. People usually tend to be one or the other, it seems.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Usually rely more heavily on one or the other if they know both, but I'm pretty much equal in that way.
And then so go to your teenage years and...
Yeah, right. So I was playing piano, you know, all through my grade school years. And I actually in fourth, fifth and sixth grade, some friends and I had a kind of a, what we called a rock band. It was like me on piano and someone had a nylon string guitar and someone had a snare drum. And we just tried to learn rock and roll and Motown songs off the radio and play them. And just after school every day, that's what we do just for fun. And that was a great part, a really important part, I think, of my musical development, actually, because it was such great ear training, you know. Yeah. We did it all, everything by ear, and just had a blast, you know, down in the basement there banging away. It was like a laboratory or something.
But so. Rock and roll didn't pull you into its clutches, though.
No, it didn't. I mean, I liked it. I listened to it a lot on the radio, and it was fun playing with my friends, but that's not really what ended up, you know, pulling me in. Really, it's always been acoustic instruments that have really engaged me. So I started playing, I guess in around sixth grade, I branched out to the guitar and the cello, actually. I played cello for about 3 years, and I played in my junior high orchestra. But I quit because the director of the orchestra made us, it was very competitive. He made us challenge each other for first chair or second chair every week. And I couldn't stand that. And I was always getting first or second chair, and everyone else resented me for it. And I decided to quit. There was no joy in the music, so that ended my cello playing.
Being teacher's pet was no fun, huh?
No, it wasn't. Because the whole atmosphere of all the kids was this kind of competitive, cutthroat thing, you know? Who's going to get first chair?
Unfortunately, that element seems to enter into music quite regularly with young children.
Yeah.
The rivalry.
Yeah, I don't know. I've always felt that artistic creation and competition are antithetical to each other. I've never entered any contests and have no desire to do that. And I know that some people, in the Irish music tradition, there's a lot of competition. And some musicians have told me they really enjoyed the social world around that. So I know for some people that's been good, but I don't think that, you know, evaluating and putting one artistic expression above another, it's counter to the whole spirit of art, I think.
But certainly when you got to the conservatory, you encountered that, correct?
Yeah, I guess I did, although when I went to music school, I was a composition major. I feel like the composition students were kind of out on the fringes of there wasn't all that much competition because what were we competing for? I mean, the only kind of career you could follow directly out of that would be to teach composition at some music school, and I actually had no desire to do that. So I didn't feel like I was competing with any of the other composition students for jobs or anything. Here we were, you know, writing this kind of avant-garde music, and there was very little competition that I felt there.
What kind of music were you trying to write at that time? Will you say avant-garde?
Yeah.
Charles Ives, or what were you trying to do?
Goodness. It seemed like my professors, my music composition teachers, were always encouraging us to really just explore the limits of what we could do with music in a very intellectual way. It was very much in the head and very analytical and abstract. And that was pretty cool. I mean, I can spend a lot of time there. I enjoy that. While at the same time that I was studying composition and doing this very cerebral, analytical, and solitary activity, I was also playing traditional folk music all the time with my friends, with older immigrants from Ireland who are in their 60s and 70s. And that's almost, it's such a huge contrast to the experience of studying composition in a music school. It's in a way, it's the opposite because it's totally community oriented, not solitary at all. It's not you trying to express your deepest self. It's you joining in with other people to experience a community expression of music, you know, mm-hmm. and traditions that have gone on for centuries. And it's all about the joy of making music together with other people. And it's very, very different from the music school composition experience. And I loved them both. But over time, it became really clear to me that where I wanted to spend my life's energy was in the community music making area, not the very solitary, isolating, what I found to be isolating experience of being a avant-garde composer. Because, you know, you'd spend 6 or 7 weeks, you know, working like crazy composing this piece of music. And then if you were smart and wrote it for specific people that you knew would play it in a recital, you get to hear it once and never again. And it wasn't played very well that one time. And no one would ever hear it again. It's like, what am I really doing this for? You know, what impact is this having? How is it contributing to the world? And for just in my own satisfaction was, I don't know, it just felt like I'd put so much of myself into this piece of music and it only gets realized once and not very well. And that's the end. So to me, after 4 years of pursuing that, I decided that's enough. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not attracted to that anymore.
You must have been a fairly unusual kid, really, to be seeking out old-timers from the old country in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
How'd you go about that?
Mainly it was through other people who knew about my interests. For example, when I was still in Cincinnati, when I was 18, there was a friend of mine named Jim Tarbell. He knew that I was learning traditional Irish music, and he said, you know, there's this guy over across the river in Covington, Kentucky, an old man named Michael Kennedy, and he plays the melodeon, which is a small, very small little accordion. He plays it in this pub over in Covington every week, and you ought to go hear him, you know. So I jumped at the chance to do that because, I mean, when you're learning a traditional music, you're learning old music that has roots that go way back in time, and it's not something that you can really learn very well from books and recordings. I certainly did as much of that as I could, but the real root of that experience is finding people who grew up immersed in that music and people who have been playing it for all their lives, and the old people are the best of all because they've had so much experience and, you know, the music has been a part of their lives for so many decades. To find an older person like that who grew up immersed in a tradition of music, that's like finding a diamond mine. And I knew that from very early on. So when I heard about this guy, Michael Kennedy, I first chance I got, I went over and met him and heard him play and introduced myself to him and very quickly became good friends. Because a lot of times those people are really hungry to share what they know with younger people. I mean, they want the tradition to live on and continue, and they want to find people who love that music.
In time, you found your way from Cincinnati to Bloomington. How did you make that transition?
It really was music that brought me to Bloomington and the musical community that I discovered here in the middle 1970s. Mm-hmm. Malcolm Dalglish and I both were playing together starting around 1975, 1976, and we met Dylan Buston, who lived in Bloomington, and through a friendship with him, started coming to Bloomington to visit and hang out and play with Dylan. And Dylan introduced us to a bunch of folks who live in Bloomington, and we go to these parties at people's houses, these sort of small little bungalows on the west side of Bloomington, and people would move all the furniture out of the living room, and so there'd be enough room to have like a square dance of 8 people, or maybe if it was a big enough house, 2 squares. People would get out their fiddles and banjos and guitars and play music, and people would dance to it, and someone would be teaching the dance, and I had never really experienced a house party like that before, and it was great. I mean, it was what I was talking about earlier, how music is part of a whole big social world of friendships and people having fun making music and making dance together in their homes. And this was happening all the time in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. And kept coming here, meeting more people. For me, there were certain musicians who I felt, wow, I've got a lot I could learn from this new friend of mine with Irish music. There were a couple of musicians here who were really knowledgeable and who I loved to play with, and with old-time music as well. And those were my two main interests at that time. So Bloomington was like, wow, I want to spend time there with those people from whom I can, so I have so much to learn, and go to all those dance parties in people's houses and the Wednesday night contra dance, which has been going for over 30 years now here in Bloomington. You know, I grew up in a much bigger city, and Yeah, you could ride your bike across town so easily. And I thought, yeah, this is the kind of place I'd like to live. And eventually, in 1981, I did decide to settle here. So Malcolm and I, Bloomington, and the people and community of Bloomington played a huge part in our development as performers and as a duo performing. And then we decided to invite Pete Sutherland to join us and make a trio, which we later on decided to call Metamora, which is named for a small town in southern Indiana. The Bloomington music scene has been such a nurturing scene for me and for Malcolm Dalglish and Pete Sutherland, too, and for many, many other musicians who have lived here or passed through here. Yeah, I don't know. There's something very, very special about Bloomington. And like I said, IU certainly has something central to do with it, but there's a lot more to it than that, too. It's
mysterious.
It's kind of mysterious, one of those vortexes. You know, there are a few others like it, too.
In the 1970s and 80s, Gray Larson and the musicians and folklorists he was spending time with did a lot to bring out the music of Lotus Dickey, the namesake of Bloomington's annual Lotus Festival of World Music and Arts. Their combined efforts resulted in the Lotus Dickey Songbook, an IU Press publication now in its second edition, which provides a history of the bluegrass musician from Paoli, Indiana, and transcriptions of more than 100 of his songs. Gray, have there been any other discoveries like Lotus Dickey for you?
One of my best friends is a man named Joe Dawson. He's 79, and he lives here in Bloomington, has lived in Bloomington, over on the west side where I live, for 40 years or so. And he plays the fiddle. And he was born in Bedford, and then his father died when he was young, and he went to live with his grandparents on a farm, which is now underneath Lake Monroe.
In Elkinsville.
Elkinsville area, mm-hmm. Right. So the farm kind of straddled the Brown County, Monroe County line. And Joe's grandfather, Jasper Chambers, played the fiddle. And as Joe describes, you know, growing up out there on the farm and in that area just south of town, there were just loads of fiddlers and banjo players and just very rich in music being made down there, you know, in people's homes. And there was even, I think he said, the local postman played the ukulele, and he built a cabin specifically for musical gatherings. And every Saturday night, people would come there to play and bring some work, some beans that had to be hulled or quilts to be stitched, and people would dance. Not really organized social dancing, but just improvised flat-footing and clogging. And so that was, you know, just a very central part of his life growing up. And so he learned lots of traditional tunes from his grandfather and from the other musicians in this community. And he's been playing that music all his life. He started playing when he was 10. I want to do a book about Joe and the transcriptions of his music. And he has a very specific and beautiful style of fiddle playing that's really unique to him and to this region. It's on my list of important projects to write a book, transcribe the music, write about the music and how he plays it and have recordings of it and have it all kind of be a package. And I've been getting together with him every week for almost 8 years now. And I know his entire repertoire. I know how he phrases the music. I know how he fingers the music, which is unusual. I know all the nuances of how he slides the finger up to a certain note. Because I'm there in the same room with him, and I watch him, and I listen to him. And he wants me to learn all that stuff because he wants it to be preserved and not die with him. But I also know all about his grandfather, who he learned it from. I know what it was like for him growing up in the Depression. And I know about, you know, the fiddle that he and his grandfather shared because they could only afford one fiddle in their family. And I know that Joe made a fiddle once. And I know so much about all the musicians that he learned from. I know what the titles refer to. I mean, the music is part of this huge, breathing, living thing. I just can't think of the right word, a good word for that. But it's not just a tune. It's a part of, it's a legacy that you're nurturing and understanding and loving and carrying on, and it changes. Mm-hmm. When I learn a tune and I play a tune, it's now part of my life, and someone learns it from me. There's another layer So there's all these layers and layers and layers of stories and meaning that go back in generations and generations and, mm-hmm. and back farther than you can ever know to people that you'll never know about who lived, you know, 150 years ago. And even though you don't know who they are, when you learn those tunes, you're learning about them. You're receiving something from them. Mm-hmm. And it's just a phenomenal thing. Now that we're also wired and we have all this access to information and on the internet, and it's so seductive to a lot of us, including me. You know, I love the internet, and you know, I could, you know, find myself, you know, wandering through the internet, and you know, hours go by, and but you're missing something when it's just you and your computer, and you are reaching out to other people, but not they're not in the same room with you, and you can't listen to them breathe or watch their facial expressions, or you know, it's. So I think it's true that a lot of people are becoming more aware of how important and unreplaceable it is to just sit down in a room with other people and then play music and learn music by listening to them and just chatting about what's going on in their life. And so that music is, for me, I'm really lucky in that playing music for me can't be separated from the experience of knowing another person, getting to know another person, and knowing a lot about them and caring about who they are, what goes on in their life. And when I learn a tune from someone, I also learn who they learned it from and under what circumstances and when that was and what it meant to them and that other person that they learned it from, what did it, you know, who did they learn it from and what role did it play in their life? You know, and all of that is this kind of organic.
This is Yael Cassander speaking with musician Gray Larson on WFIU's Profiles. Gray, I'd like to ask you to choose one of your own compositions to share with us. Tell us about the piece you've selected.
Yeah, The Gathering. This is a piece of music that I composed on a Norwegian traditional instrument called a hardanger fiddle, or hardingfele in Norwegian is how they would say it. It's a beautiful instrument, an instrument that I became really in love with in the late 70s, early 80s especially. My family is part Norwegian, one quarter Norwegian, and the musical heritage in my family seems to have come through that lineage. All my Norwegian ancestors seem to have been musical. And the hardanger fiddle has four strings like a regular fiddle or violin, but it has four extra strings that are what they call resonating strings or sympathetic strings that just vibrate on their own while you play the primary strings. So there's kind of this aura or halo of resonating sound surrounding you as you play the instrument. These strings, these sympathetic strings, are not being touched at all by your fingers. You just tune them precisely so that they pick up the resonance of the other notes and just start vibrating on their own. So it's quite a subtle and beautiful thing. And it's a great instrument that really grabs me. I love it. So I've written a few pieces using that instrument. This one, it's kind of like a Norwegian wedding march. There's a genre in traditional Norwegian music of wedding marches. It's kind of in that rhythm and that feeling to it. And I don't know why I called it The Gathering. It just seems to have to do with gatherings of people in my mind. And it certainly draws upon Norwegian traditional music. But if someone from Norway heard it, they wouldn't say, oh, that's a traditional Norwegian piece, isn't it? And there's something different about it that I don't know. It just comes from me and my classical music background in part. But to me, it's a very moving piece and one that I do cherish. Thank you.
We've been listening to The Gathering, the title track from a 1986 recording of original instrumentals by Gray Larson, my guest on Profiles. In addition to the music you compose and play, one of the accomplishments for which you've received great renown has been the publication of your books, The Essential Guide to Irish Flute and Tin Whistle, and The Essential Tin Whistle Toolbox. Tell us a bit about the books and how they came about.
Well, when I started teaching, I started being invited to teach traditional Irish music at music festivals around the country, and sometimes a week-long workshop. I still teach a lot of those, three or four every summer. You know, I had really learned about Irish flute and tin whistle playing, and mainly from these older Irish immigrants who had come to Cincinnati and Cleveland, Ohio. And I really had learned in a traditional, like one would learn if you were immersed in that music as a youngster in Ireland, is really just by immersing myself in it and being around these people who played it and playing with them and picking things up and watching and asking questions. And you kind of, if you listen carefully enough and long enough and watch what people are doing, you kind of absorb what's happening and learn how to do it without ever being terribly analytical about it. That's really how I learned. But then when I went to teach at these workshops, it was a whole different thing. I only had a few days or a week with a group of people who wanted to learn this, and I wanted to convey the essence of what I had learned to them. But they didn't have the good fortune that I'd had to have all this time to absorb it, you know, in a more traditional way. So since I did have a music school background and very fluent with music notation and kind of ways of analyzing music and thinking analytically, I came up with some ideas of how to convey, for example, the ornamentation techniques in Irish music, which are very, very central to the music. How to convey that to people, how it works, and a way to notate it so they could take something home with them and be working on it on their own time. And actually kind of created a notational system for that aspect of the music. And people started suggesting to me, wow, you know, this is pretty interesting what you're doing. You really ought to, you know, write this all down in a booklet or something. And I started to take that idea more seriously over the years and started to write a book. And it really began as something much smaller than what it turned into. The book I've written, the Essential Guide to Irish Flute and Tin Whistle, turned out after 9 or 10 years of working on it to be a much more comprehensive work. It's 480 pages, a lot of stuff in there.
And would you say this is an unprecedented effort with regard to this instrument and this sort of music?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Apparently so. You know, I didn't really think about that when I was writing. But as I was writing, I kept thinking of more things to write about and taking the work I'd already developed much further. And then I thought, well, I've got all these sort of tools now to notate and understand and conceptualize what's going on in the style, the various styles in Irish music. How about, why don't I try to actually apply that to take some old recordings of great flute and whistle players from the 1920s on up to the present and transcribe them and actually notate everything they're doing, all the phrasing, all the ornamentation, all the improvisation, because now I've got these tools. For the first time, you can actually do that and see it all clearly in front of you and listen to the recording and understand exactly what's going on. So a lot of the book, about 100 pages or so, are transcriptions of these historical recordings, and no one had ever attempted to do that before, as far as I can tell, at least not in published form that I could find. So, yeah, the book has gotten a great reception, you know, and it's so gratifying to get letters and emails from people who write to me and tell me that, you know, my work has just really opened the door for them to learn this music that they had never been able to really get a handle on before. That's so satisfying.
It's thrilling. And then you have the companion piece, which is the
Essential Tin Whistle Toolbox.
And so that's more of a manual, of actual how-to.
Yeah, it's an instructional book without as so much of the historical material, and it doesn't have the transcriptions of the historical recordings. It's more of a quicker entry and nuts and bolts approach. So, yeah, those books have continued to sell quite well, and they've opened all kinds of doors for me, to come and teach at other places in Ireland and in the Netherlands and Australia, and connected me with a lot of opportunities and people.
Speaking of those connections, in addition to Malcolm Dalglish and Joe Dawson, you've partnered with plenty of other musicians around the world, including Andre Marchand and Patti League. Tell us about some of those collaborations.
Yeah, Andre Marchand is a great musician and a wonderful friend. He's from Quebec. He lives in Joliette, which is northeast of Montreal, about an hour's drive. And he used to be in a band called La Bottine Souriante. People who know French-Canadian music will certainly know that band. They're kind of the seminal revival traditional music group from Quebec. It started in the 70s, kind of the same time that I was starting to play music with Malcolm. They were exploring the tradition, their local traditions.
The smiling boot.
Right. What La Bottine Souriante.
Okay,
means.
Right.
And there's this foot tapping in Quebec music where there's almost constantly this kind of rhythm going on with the tapping the feet while you're playing or singing. So I think that's where their name came from. Well, I would be traveling a lot and performing at folk festivals all over the U.S. and Canada, and very often I would run into Andre at the same festival where the La Bottine Souriante would be playing. And I loved his music, and he loved my music, and we became, you know, good friends. And kind of where it all intersected is Irish music, because music, traditional music in Quebec, is part of it is deeply rooted in Irish music. So we knew a lot of tunes in common, so it was very easy to, at, you know, some backstage area at a festival to just sit down and play together. I didn't really know a lot of French-Canadian music. I loved that music and listened to it a lot, but I had never tried to play it. But we could both play Irish music, so we had a common ground. And so we just decided, since we were good friends and had a common interest, that we'd just sit down and see what happened. And he encouraged me to play traditional music from Quebec. And I thought, I don't know. I don't play the right instrument. They don't really play flutes or concertina in Quebec. And I don't know that fiddle style. I don't play the button accordion like they do up there. He said, oh, so what? Just play it. So I thought, well, if one of the musicians who I respect the most from Quebec, Andre Marchand, is encouraging me to play it, I guess I'll try. So we ended up exploring what we could do with Irish music and Quebecois music using the instruments that we played. And actually, something really special came out of that. And we've made two recordings. One we made in, 1991, I think, called The Orange Tree. And then we made another one about in 2002 or 2003 called Les Marionnettes. And in these projects, we took Irish music and French-Canadian music, music from Quebec and from the Acadian regions further east, and just integrated the two using guitar and voice. He's a guitarist and singer and does a great foot percussionist. And then for me, using the flute and tin whistle and the concertina and piano and pump organ. Harmonium is one kind of pump organ, and just sort of let our imaginations go. And what we came up with is a couple of recordings that actually are very, very highly respected in Quebec, which is really gratifying to me. A lot of the musicians from that area really love what we've done. And again, it's something about the modern age that we're in and all the travel and access that we have to music of the world. You make friendships with people. Mm-hmm. Really, that's the root of all of it for me is friendship. You make a friendship with a musician, and once you really get to know someone well, and you're both musicians, you want to play music together. So you figure out, well, where do we intersect? What can we do? And that wouldn't have happened 150 years ago and so much when people weren't. I suppose it did happen some, but not as much. It's not so easy for that to happen back in those days as it is now.
Let's take a listen to one of those collaborative efforts, a 1993 recording with Andre Marchand. What are we going to be hearing, Gray?
It starts with this particular Acadian mouth music tune that Andre learned from an old man in New Brunswick. What's called mouth music. It's from the area of Maritime Canada that's referred to as Acadia or Acadie in French. Just a very old tune that instead of being played, it's sung just to nonsense syllables. if there was no instruments to be had, you could still have a dance. Someone would sing a danceable tune and people would dance to it. And then I composed a tune to go with that piece of math music. And I call that tune Horses, Geese, and One Old Man. The tune definitely has an Irish feeling to it, and it definitely also has a Quebecois, French-Canadian feel to it, especially in the form of the music. It's very irregular and what we call crooked. And I accompany it with this pump organ called a field organ, something that was designed for military chaplains to take out in the battlefield. This is just a particular sound, a very dark, beautiful sound. And then after that tune, we return to the original mouth music tune and combine the flute and the guitar and the pump organ and the feet and the singing. And I wrote kind of a flute counterpoint to go with the singing. By the end of this piece of music, everything is going on at once.
We've just heard Acadian mouth music, or Rilabouche Acadien, Horses, Geese, and One Old Man. The first track from Gray Larson and André Marchand's 1993 album, The Orange Tree. Gray, you're currently recording and touring with a different musician. Tell us about Cindy Callett.
Cindy is a fabulous guitarist and singer. Just amazing. And a writer of songs. She's been writing songs since she was 10 or 11 years old. And she's, you know, had a lifetime of music. She also plays fiddle and some banjo and a number of string instruments. She is just one of the finest musicians I know. And I had, before I knew her personally, I really admired her work, her recordings. And same for her. Before she knew me, she was sort of following my music too. Her background is not quite as deeply in the traditional roots as mine, although she knows a lot, always has listened to traditional music a lot. But it was more in the songwriting vein. And she's from New England, and she's known for her writing about the New England coast and maritime music, and that's really what people know her for, although there's more to her than that. So we've been, for about 4 years, maybe 3.5 years, we've been exploring, you know, what we could do together musically, and it's been great. She has all the contrapuntal sense that I have. It's always, as a kid, like, Bach was just my favorite thing. I would go to the public library and check out one book of Bach keyboard music and just take it home and try to plow through it. I couldn't play it very well, but I would work my way through all of the counterpoint and just do that all the time. And I'm still really fascinated by contrapuntal music like that. And Cindy is the same way. Her guitar playing is exquisite in that way. So I think we're a good match for each other, and we've stretched each other musically. You know, she's learned a lot more about traditional Irish music and old-time music through me, and I play more improvisationally when I accompany her with her songs. I get a lot of chance to improvise, especially mm-hmm. with the flute.
So your debut recording with Cindy is forthcoming. Any other projects on the horizon?
I'm doing a couple more Irish music books mm-hmm. that I'm in the middle of completing. Mm-hmm. Actually, what I'm hoping to do, I mentioned earlier, a book of Joe Dawson's music and recordings with that. That's a goal of mine. I want to write a lot more music. I've got a lot more composing in me, and I'm doing that with Cindy, and I want to do a lot more of that. Actually, there's a book project that I would love to do, too. I actually applied for a Guggenheim Fellowship this year. I didn't receive one. It's very difficult to get one. But I really want to explore the idea of how to help people learn by ear. musicians who feel that they are dependent on music notation and want to break free of that dependency and be able to really use their ears. That's something that I've encountered for the last 30 years that I've been teaching workshops. A lot of people are in that situation. That's something I really would love to explore in a deep way and write a very a useful book about that.
Do you have theories about it? Is it mostly a psychological allowing of oneself, or?
I think a big part of it is, especially musicians who have grown up in a classical music approach, there's a lot of musicians for whom music playing always goes through a visual channel, a graphic representational channel of music notation on paper. And there's something about that that is so, it's so beautiful. It works so well. I mean, there's so much information contained in that page of music notation. It's really incredible. It's so useful, and especially for music that is too complex to be easily memorized, that music can remain kind of external in a sense, where you can't play it without having that visual representation. That means you haven't internalized it completely. You have to have that external aspect, or you just can't play. And so much of my life has been, so much of the joy of my life is playing music in informal settings with people where there's no music notation going on. It's just playing music that is designed to be internalized easily. You know, the tune, an Irish fiddle tune, it's not that complicated formally. You know, the form is very simple. It's short. It's not that hard to memorize. It doesn't go on for 5 minutes without repeating itself. You know, it's very repetitious, really. But it's what goes on within these very simple, small structures. It's endlessly beautiful and never the same twice, you know, the very small-scale improvisation that goes on. So that experience of playing music with people without needing any kind of external representation of the music, like notation, is the most joyful thing I've ever experienced. And there's a lot of people who want to do that but feel that they can't play without the sheet of music in front of them. And I think part of it has to do with the way our brains work. And I think processing music through a visual representation has got to be very different inside our brains. Another aspect of, like you alluded to, is just sort of the fear of failure. A lot of people who grew up in classical music, they don't want to make any mistakes. I mean, to make a mistake, that's bad. And there's a lot of judgment that goes on in classical music, a lot of criticism and evaluation and trying to be good enough or as good as another player, a lot of competition. So there's a lot of that tied up. I think a lot of people have that going on too, just a fear of going out on a limb and making a mistake, playing something that's a wrong note. I mean, playing wrong notes and making mistakes is what leads you to discovering what you want to play. And there's all these different versions of fiddle tunes out there. The same tune, there might be 30 different versions of it. That's because people play it in their own way and they make something else. Probably because they can't exactly remember how they heard it, someone else play it, they find another way to play it. That's embraced, that's cherished in traditional music. I really would like to study how different ethnic musical traditions have handled this. Like, for example, Balinese and Javanese gamelan music. It's kind of straddling the line between a classical music form and a traditional folk music form. There is music notation for the different instruments in the Javanese and Balinese gamelan orchestra, but it's very rudimentary. It doesn't try to notate everything like we do in Western classical music, almost everything, all the phrasing and
crescendo, diminuendo,
yeah,
et cetera.
All of that. Okay. Yeah, it depends on the musician internalizing it to a great degree, but it's kind of a roadmap for these long, complex pieces and patterns. So that's really intriguing to me. That's kind of halfway in between. And so I'd really like to really study how music is taught in folk and ethnic traditions, and in traditions that kind of approach classical music. And then I'd like to devise some tools, and I'm thinking in terms of kind of experiential, almost like games, musical games, or that you could play where you'd start to exercise these other parts of your brain, where you take in music purely in an oral sense without notation and start to internalize it.
It sounds very helpful. Gray, before we have to say goodbye, I'd like you to tell us about the music you've chosen to take us out. And tell us why this music from Monteverdi's Vespers of the Blessed Virgin is meaningful to you.
I guess when I was going to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music, I was studying music composition on the one hand, and I was also very involved with the early music group there, the Collegium Musicum. And I think probably the most inspiring professor I ever had was the director of that group, and Dean Nurnberger was his name. He's no longer living. Just a he was so. It was kind of like my father when he was listening to classical music when I was a kid. He'd get so totally swept up in the music and the love and the passion of the music that he'd almost lose himself. I mean, he'd almost lose touch with him. He'd just be out there with his, when he would be directing the ensemble, it's almost like he disappeared. His ego or his personality or, you know, almost disappeared, and he just embodied the music in such a powerful way. And I think it was through him that I discovered the music of Monteverdi. And this particular, one of the pieces is called The Vespers of 1610. It's a large work with many, many different parts. But I think, now my expertise in early music has faded over the years, but I think that Monteverdi was one of the first to really orchestrate music in a very specific way. I think a lot of early music, Renaissance and medieval music for sure, was written without specifying exactly in that it should be played by this instrument. You know, a lot of it could be sung or played. It was up to the musicians to kind of determine that. But Monteverdi, I think, was one of the first to really orchestrate music in a real specific way. I don't know, there's something about the tone colors that he created that way, when the art of orchestration was so fresh and new, there's something indescribably beautiful about the way he did that, with the cornettos and the recorders and violins and sackbuts and theorbos and I mean, just I found that very inspiring. Just the spaces he created, the energies and rhythms and textures. I don't know how to put it in words better than that. But it's like I carry that inside. It's one of the sounds, landscapes or something that I seem to carry inside me all the time. And I'm sure it has informed what I write.
We've been listening to a performance by the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque soloists led by John Elliott Gardner of Salmus Laudate Pueri from Claudio Monteverdi's Vespro della Beata Virgine. Music selected by our guest on Profiles this evening, Gray Larson. For Profiles, I'm Yael Cassander.
The program you just heard was recorded in June of 2007. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.